Egzamin maturalny z języka angielskiego. Poziom dwujęzyczny. Usłyszysz dwukrotnie teksty do zadań od pierwszego do trzeciego. Przed wysłuchaniem każdego tekstu usłyszysz dźwięk. W nagraniu przewidziane są przerwy na zapoznanie się z poleceniami oraz treścią zadań, sygnalizowane dźwiękiem. Rozwiązuj poszczególne zadania w trakcie słuchania nagrań oraz w czasie przerw po ich wysłuchaniu.
Task 1. Read the instructions and the task carefully.
Speaker A. Over the last few decades, online learning has become well established in higher education. Online MBA programs are on the rise, and universities now offer online courses to accommodate full-time work with long commutes, or to circumvent the need to move to a new location, the expense of which can be prohibitive, especially if you've got a family. But I think that the digital shift will ultimately necessitate a complete overhaul of the traditional model of teaching. One-hour lectures and workshops will need to be broken up into smaller 10 to 20-minute webinars, interspersed with practical exercises and question and answer sessions. I also believe that enhanced support for students is essential, as much more guidance is required when they're not in the classroom. And I hope it's obvious to everyone that online learning cannot easily replace the laboratory-based learning often required by the natural sciences. That will present challenges, but I'm sure in time they will be overcome. I'm delighted to see so many professors using new high-tech tools and experimenting with innovative ways of providing quality education remotely.
Speaker B. I've heard lots of universities are facing major budget cuts, just like mine. They are planning to move teaching online, but some of them don't have the core infrastructure to do this. Most universities seek to partner with private companies in order to deliver online courses. But the companies are only really interested in the top universities, whose brands attract high fee-paying students. But such universities already have huge budgets for everything, including IT. Others who need it the most are often left out. I also think that university senior managers underestimate the difficulty of delivering learning online. For example, I was given a week's notice to put my courses online and a fortnight to develop a digital education strategy. That's ridiculous. There is a danger that we'll see a backlash against online learning because there has been a rush to do it, which might end disastrously. Speaker C.
While the term university is usually associated with packed auditoriums, full labs, and chaotic discussions in common rooms, on stairs, and in corridors, this might not remain true much longer. More and more students are deciding to forgo traditional higher education and instead are signing up for online degree courses. However, while there are many arguments in favour of distance learning, there are also some serious reservations. First of all, there's the question of the quality of the education delivered. Before we abandon traditional education, let's ask ourselves, how does the online experience compare with face-to-face learning from an objective standpoint? In-person learning allows teachers to get to know their students much better because they can pick up signals from their students that go unnoticed in an online setting. Most importantly, interacting face-to-face builds bonds of trust among the students as well as between them and their tutors. If a student runs out of motivation during a course or wants to quit, the competitive and collaborative atmosphere of the university campus can be a crucial reinvigorating factor.
Speaker D. Online classes require significantly more motivation and attention. During yesterday's seminar, the monotonous voice of the lecturer was so tedious that I started browsing the internet on my computer. That's a problem that not only I experience. Many students get bored and distracted during classes. I also think that the turn to online platforms is disrupting whole curricula, particularly in the case of professors who are less proficient at navigating the internet and managing a classroom mediated by screen and microphone. With university IT services focusing their efforts on providing professors with quality equipment and how-to webinars on using online platforms, the needs of individual students have been sidelined, and less affluent students with poor quality gear and dodgy internet access are seriously disadvantaged. Another thing is that webinar technology doesn't quite live up to the hype. The noise of rustling papers, ambulances, kettles, and even the wind can make it impossible to hear what the speaker is saying. Listen to the recording once again.
Speaker A. Over the last few decades, online learning has become well established in higher education. Online MBA programs are on the rise, and universities now offer online courses to accommodate full-time work with long commutes, or to circumvent the need to move to a new location, the expense of which can be prohibitive, especially if you've got a family. But I think that the digital shift will ultimately necessitate a complete overhaul of the traditional model of teaching. One-hour lectures and workshops will need to be broken up into smaller 10 to 20-minute webinars, interspersed with practical exercises and question and answer sessions. I also believe that enhanced support for students is essential, as much more guidance is required when they're not in the classroom. And I hope it's obvious to everyone that online learning cannot easily replace the laboratory-based learning often required by the natural sciences. That will present challenges, but I'm sure in time they will be overcome. I'm delighted to see so many professors using new high-tech tools and experimenting with innovative ways of providing quality education remotely.
Speaker B. I've heard lots of universities are facing major budget cuts, just like mine. They are planning to move teaching online, but some of them don't have the core infrastructure to do this. Most universities seek to partner with private companies in order to deliver online courses, but the companies are only really interested in the top universities whose brands attract high fee-paying students. But such universities already have huge budgets for everything, including IT. Others who need it the most are often left out. I also think that university senior managers underestimate the difficulty of delivering learning online. For example, I was given a week's notice to put my courses online and a fortnight to develop a digital education strategy. That's ridiculous. There is a danger that we'll see a backlash against online learning because there has been a rush to do it, which might end disastrously. Speaker C.
While the term university is usually associated with packed auditoriums, full labs, and chaotic discussions in common rooms, on stairs, and in corridors, this might not remain true much longer. More and more students are deciding to forgo traditional higher education and instead are signing up for online degree courses. However, while there are many arguments in favour of distance learning, there are also some serious reservations. First of all, there's the question of the quality of the education delivered. Before we abandon traditional education, let's ask ourselves, how does the online experience compare with face-to-face learning from an objective standpoint? In-person learning allows teachers to get to know their students much better because they can pick up signals from their students that go unnoticed in an online setting. Most importantly, interacting face-to-face builds bonds of trust among the students as well as between them and their tutors. If a student runs out of motivation during a course or wants to quit, the competitive and collaborative atmosphere of the university campus can be a crucial reinvigorating factor.
Speaker D. Online classes require significantly more motivation and attention. During yesterday's seminar, the monotonous voice of the lecturer was so tedious that I started browsing the internet on my computer. That's a problem that not only I experience. Many students get bored and distracted during classes. I also think that the turn to online platforms is disrupting whole curricula, particularly in the case of professors who are less proficient at navigating the internet and managing a classroom mediated by screen and microphone. With university IT services focusing their efforts on providing professors with quality equipment and how-to webinars on using online platforms, the needs of individual students have been sidelined, and less affluent students with poor quality gear and dodgy internet access are seriously disadvantaged. Another thing is that webinar technology doesn't quite live up to the hype. The noise of rustling papers, ambulances, kettles, and even the wind can make it impossible to hear what the speaker is saying.
Task 2. Read the instructions and the questions for Text 1 carefully. Listen to the recording for Text 1.
A multitude of sculptures of human figures depicting, for example, a group of business people talking, a couple taking a selfie, and a man lying on a couch with empty cans around him are submerged in nearly 30 feet of water off the coast of Cancun, Mexico. This is the world's largest underwater sculpture museum. Our guest today, Jason Taylor, is the museum's curator and founder. Welcome, Jason. Please tell us why you chose this particular spot for your museum.
This part of Mexico's coast is visited by a huge number of snorkelers and divers every year, and that puts a lot of pressure on the existing reefs. The museum constitutes a habitat for fish and other marine life and aspires to be a major attraction for holiday divers. The main goal of this project is to shift their attention from the natural reefs between Cancun and Isla Mujeres to artificial reefs, which is what the sculptures are designed to become. Each cement statue is engineered to attract corals, which once they've attached to it, grow and develop into their own distinct formations. The sculptures are a magnet for sea life. There are huge schools of fish that swim around the statues and use them for cover in the event that they spot any danger in their vicinity.
What do visitors experience when they dive down to the sculptures?
They enjoy the feeling of weightlessness combined with the refreshing coolness of the water. Sounds are muted and visibility is either reduced or improved, depending on factors such as tides, wind and rain. Changes on the surface of the sea have an impact right down to the ocean floor. That is why no two visits to see any given sculpture will be quite the same. Additionally, the depth alters the spectrum of colours that can be seen. Ocean currents also change the visual dynamic of these artworks. And finally, as each artwork grows, the original forms become obscured, so a regular visitor can track the passage of time by these gradual changes. So, unsurprisingly, it's a completely different way of experiencing exhibits than in a traditional white-walled museum.
And finally, does your museum have any negative impacts on the environment?
We've done our best to avoid doing any harm, but time will tell. All the sculptures have been created using a non-toxic pH-neutral marine cement, which is free from harmful pollutants. Indeed, eventually they will become an integral part of the local ecosystem. Each work is produced in consultation with marine scientists, so they themselves can study and monitor the development of a functioning ecosystem from its very beginning. The museum also provides alternative employment for fishermen in the area, whom we retrain as guides. Admission fees guarantee crucial funding for other marine conservation efforts, including the support of coastal patrols, which try to ensure that environmental law is complied with.
Well, thank you, Jason, for being with us today. And I have a feeling that some of our listeners may well be visiting you in the near future.
Listen to the recording once again.
A multitude of sculptures of human figures depicting, for example, a group of business people talking, a couple taking a selfie, and a man lying on a couch with empty cans around him are submerged in nearly 30 feet of water off the coast of Cancun, Mexico. This is the world's largest underwater sculpture museum. Our guest today, Jason Taylor, is the museum's curator and founder. Welcome, Jason. Please tell us why you chose this particular spot for your museum.
This part of Mexico's coast is visited by a huge number of snorkelers and divers every year, and that puts a lot of pressure on the existing reefs. The museum constitutes a habitat for fish and other marine life and aspires to be a major attraction for holiday divers. The main goal of this project is to shift their attention from the natural reefs between Cancun and Isla Mujeres to artificial reefs, which is what the sculptures are designed to become. Each cement statue is engineered to attract corals, which once they've attached to it, grow and develop into their own distinct formations. The sculptures are a magnet for sea life. There are huge schools of fish that swim around the statues and use them for cover in the event that they spot any danger in their vicinity.
What do visitors experience when they dive down to the sculptures?
They enjoy the feeling of weightlessness combined with the refreshing coolness of the water. Sounds are muted and visibility is either reduced or improved, depending on factors such as tides, wind and rain. Changes on the surface of the sea have an impact right down to the ocean floor. That is why no two visits to see any given sculpture will be quite the same. Additionally, the depth alters the spectrum of colours that can be seen. Ocean currents also change the visual dynamic of these artworks. And finally, as each artwork grows, the original forms become obscured, so a regular visitor can track the passage of time by these gradual changes. So, unsurprisingly, it's a completely different way of experiencing exhibits than in a traditional white-walled museum.
And finally, does your museum have any negative impacts on the environment?
We've done our best to avoid doing any harm, but time will tell. All the sculptures have been created using a non-toxic pH-neutral marine cement, which is free from harmful pollutants. Indeed, eventually they will become an integral part of the local ecosystem. Each work is produced in consultation with marine scientists, so they themselves can study and monitor the development of a functioning ecosystem from its very beginning. The museum also provides alternative employment for fishermen in the area, whom we retrain as guides. Admission fees guarantee crucial funding for other marine conservation efforts, including the support of coastal patrols, which try to ensure that environmental law is complied with.
Well, thank you, Jason, for being with us today. And I have a feeling that some of our listeners may well be visiting you in the near future.
Read the questions for text 2. Listen to the recording for text 2.
There is an unusual sight to be found in the small settlement of Pika Pika on the windswept west coast of New Zealand's North Island. At first glance, it looks like a series of modest hillocks, but on closer inspection, it turns out that some of them have windows and small white towers that rise above the landscape like periscopes. It's probably fair to say that this structure is a hidden gem, which is what it was intended to be. This is a house that was disguised in order to avoid falling foul of planning regulations, which at the time of the house's construction stipulated that no building should be visible from the beach. Modernist architect Fritz Eisenhofer designed and built this idiosyncratic house, as weird as it is wonderful, for his family in the late 1980s. When interviewed recently about the house, Fritz and his wife Helen stated that the big problem is that when it comes to houses, people are still thinking well inside the box. They also admitted that under current, even more stringent building regulations, they wouldn't be able to build this house today, at least in this area. While Fritz and Helen chose the site mainly due to its proximity to the sea, another factor was that the terrain lent itself to their dream of creating an earth-sheltered, energy-efficient house. The building is a series of interconnected sun-facing domes equipped with solar panels, so it's possible to store heat and conserve energy. Each dome was constructed with a thin shell of robust ferro-cement, which overlays the skeleton of the structure. The main dome, which covers the living area and an indoor swimming pool, is half-submerged in the earth to a depth of 4 meters. A closer look reveals 2 large glass panels in the curve of the dome, one facing north towards the southern hemisphere's midday sun, and another one facing west in order to trap the sun's heat later in the day. The circular front entrance repeats the house's dominant visual element and leads directly into the open-plan main dome. The all-white interior, filled with tropical plants and palm trees, has a warm microclimate. Higher than usual humidity levels are one downside of this otherwise happy arrangement. However, the glass wall, which extends to the base of the dome, was designed to make sure that any condensation drains into the garden. Fritz has incorporated swimming pools into all of his projects, and the couple have had one in every house they've lived in so far. As the weather is highly temperamental on the Pacific coast, the couple rarely swim in the sea, preferring the predictable calmness of their ozone-treated pool. As the couple point out, the thing that outshines all the whimsies of their unusual dwelling is its huge open interiors, which will always create a perfect haven of relaxation after a hectic week of work. Barely any noise comes into the dome from outside, guaranteeing the couple boundless peace and quiet.
Listen to the recording once again.
There is an unusual sight to be found in the small settlement of Pika Pika on the windswept west coast of New Zealand's North Island. At first glance, it looks like a series of modest hillocks, but on closer inspection, it turns out that some of them have windows and small white towers that rise above the landscape like periscopes. It's probably fair to say that this structure is a hidden gem, which is what it was intended to be. This is a house that was disguised in order to avoid falling foul of planning regulations, which at the time of the house's construction stipulated that no building should be visible from the beach. Modernist architect Fritz Eisenhofer designed and built this idiosyncratic house, as weird as it is wonderful, for his family in the late 1980s. When interviewed recently about the house, Fritz and his wife Helen stated that the big problem is that when it comes to houses, people are still thinking well inside the box. They also admitted that under current, even more stringent building regulations, they wouldn't be able to build this house today, at least in this area. While Fritz and Helen chose the site mainly due to its proximity to the sea, another factor was that the terrain lent itself to their dream of creating an earth-sheltered, energy-efficient house. The building is a series of interconnected sun-facing domes equipped with solar panels, so it's possible to store heat and conserve energy. Each dome was constructed with a thin shell of robust ferro-cement, which overlays the skeleton of the structure. The main dome, which covers the living area and an indoor swimming pool, is half-submerged in the earth to a depth of 4 meters. A closer look reveals two large glass panels in the curve of the dome, one facing north towards the southern hemisphere's midday sun, and another one facing west in order to trap the sun's heat later in the day. The circular front entrance repeats the house's dominant visual element and leads directly into the open-plan main dome. The all-white interior, filled with tropical plants and palm trees, has a warm microclimate. Higher than usual humidity levels are one downside of this otherwise happy arrangement. However, the glass wall, which extends to the base of the dome, was designed to make sure that any condensation drains into the garden. Fritz has incorporated swimming pools into all of his projects, and the couple have had one in every house they've lived in so far. As the weather is highly temperamental on the Pacific coast, the couple rarely swim in the sea, preferring the predictable calmness of their ozone-treated pool. As the couple point out, the thing that outshines all the whimsies of their unusual dwelling is its huge open interiors, which will always create a perfect haven of relaxation after a hectic week of work. Barely any noise comes into the dome from outside, guaranteeing the couple boundless peace and quiet.
Task 3. Read the instructions and the task carefully.
British authorities have made a new arrest in connection with a brazen 2015 robbery in London's famous Hatton Garden jewellery district, in which a gang of ageing men pulled off the largest burglary in English history. This morning, detectives arrested a 57-year-old man on suspicion of having been involved in the burglary and making off with nearly £14 million worth of cash, gold and gems. The suspect, known only by the pseudonym Basil, is believed to have been the last gang member at liberty. He was arrested after police, acting on a search warrant, seized a number of items linked to the case at his residential address in North London. He is being held at a North London police station, but no further information has been released. Six other men were each sentenced in 2016 to between 6 and 7 years behind bars for breaking into the vaults of the Hatton Garden Safe Deposit Company. The court also ruled that the gang members must pay back more than £6 million each based on their available assets or face an additional 7 years in jail. The Hatton Garden break-in had all the trappings of a typical Hollywood heist movie. The group of men, disguised as workmen, slid down the elevator shaft at Hatton Garden and used a heavy-duty, diamond-tipped drill to break through the vault walls. The thieves ransacked 73 safe deposit boxes and stuffed everything into plastic dustbins on wheels before making their getaway. The arrest will clear up the one remaining mystery in the case, the identity of the gang member known as Basil, who was filmed by security cameras during the theft, but who had avoided capture until today. The police suspect that he opened a fire escape door which allowed the rest of the gang to enter and that he was responsible for disabling the alarm protecting the safe deposit boxes. Sky News has broadcast an interview with an anonymous source who claims that Basil is a former police officer with extensive links to private security companies. However, prosecutors who know the source's identity have cautioned against giving weight to his testimony as he has misled the authorities on a number of previous occasions. A reward of £20,000 offered for information leading to Basil's arrest is said to have played a key role in bringing about this breakthrough in the case. We will bring you news of all further developments just as soon as they occur. And now the weather outlook for this evening across the southeast.
Listen to the recording once again.
British authorities have made a new arrest in connection with a brazen 2015 robbery in London's famous Hatton Garden jewellery district, in which a gang of ageing men pulled off the largest burglary in English history. This morning, detectives arrested a 57-year-old man on suspicion of having been involved in the burglary and making off with nearly £14 million worth of cash, gold and gems. The suspect, known only by the pseudonym Basil, is believed to have been the last gang member at liberty. He was arrested after police, acting on a search warrant, seized a number of items linked to the case at his residential address in North London. He is being held at a North London police station, but no further information has been released. Six other men were each sentenced in 2016 to between 6 and 7 years behind bars for breaking into the vaults of the Hatton Garden Safe Deposit Company. The court also ruled that the gang members must pay back more than £6 million each based on their available assets or face an additional 7 years in jail. The Hatton Garden break-in had all the trappings of a typical Hollywood heist movie. The group of men, disguised as workmen, slid down the elevator shaft at Hatton Garden and used a heavy-duty, diamond-tipped drill to break through the vault walls. The thieves ransacked 73 safe deposit boxes and stuffed everything into plastic dustbins on wheels before making their getaway. The arrest will clear up the one remaining mystery in the case: the identity of the gang member known as Basil, who was filmed by security cameras during the theft, but who had avoided capture until today. The police suspect that he opened a fire escape door which allowed the rest of the gang to enter and that he was responsible for disabling the alarm protecting the safe deposit boxes. Sky News has broadcast an interview with an anonymous source who claims that Basil is a former police officer with extensive links to private security companies. However, prosecutors who know the source's identity have cautioned against giving weight to his testimony as he has misled the authorities on a number of previous occasions. A reward of £20,000 offered for information leading to Basil's arrest is said to have played a key role in bringing about this breakthrough in the case. We will bring you news of all further developments just as soon as they occur. And now the weather outlook for this evening across the southeast.
Czas przeznaczony na tę część egzaminu minął.